Welcome to McGuff Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Be sure to check out our website, themcguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter, at themcguffinmen. We most recently discussed, what was the last thing we talked about, James? Was it high-quality radio, which this is? Yeah. Sitting in silence, thinking. The Fugitive. There it is. We got our DJ Khaled on. We solved it. So, follow us on Twitter at The McGuffin Men. Check out our website, themcguffinmen.com. Give us a rating on iTunes. Ignore the previous 30 seconds when rating us on iTunes. Give us a 5-star rating. Next week we'll be talking about Gone Girl, but that's next week. This is this week. So, let's see what we're talking about. Are we shooting?
What?
Are we shooting people or what?
Are we shooting?
That's what I'm asking you.
What's the answer?
I don't know the answer. That's what I'm trying to find out. All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are.
We're here.
To talk about a film.
Today, isn't it?
I'm sorry, what?
It's going to be a loose one today, isn't it?
I don't know. It's been a weird day. The weather's weird.
Right. And we took a week off, so.
Yeah, we took an accidental week off. Because I had to do some weird road trip of rural Ontario at the last second. But that's a story for another day.
Our other podcast.
Yeah. Rural Ontario with Alex and James.
Personal anecdotes with the McGuffin Men.
But we're talking about Three Kings.
We are, and actually I feel like there's a lot to talk about in this movie, and I guess it is kind of funny, so to laugh at the start of it's not completely out of taste, but
yeah, absolutely.
Three Kings.
Yes.
A 1999 comedy action dark comedy heist war movie.
Sure. I feel like you said a couple words more than once, but that's a correct classification.
Yes. And written and directed by David O. Russell.
Yes, correct. From a story by John Ridley.
Yeah, my understanding, John Ridley, the I guess most famous right now for having adapted the screenplay for 12 Years a Slave.
And his Jimi Hendrix biography movie is in theaters now, I think, probably. All's by my side.
Yeah, I still think 12 Years a Slave is going to be the credit that sticks with him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, there's also Undercover Brother, so.
True. Yeah. It did get nominated for Best Screenplay at the Black Reel Entertainment Awards. But yes, John Ridley, he claims, maybe you've heard a different story. He said he wanted to challenge or experiment in how quickly he could write and sell a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it took him 7 days to write it and 18 days to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
In a movie then called Spoils of War, which is, like Three Kings, a heist movie set in the Gulf War. I guess David O. Russell heard that brief description and decided he liked the idea a lot, but he liked it so much he didn't even want to read the script and to, quote, pollute his own ideas. And so he just really took that one sentence and wrote his own movie around that. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I kind of think it was like how Tony Gilroy approached writing the Bourne Identity movies. It's like, I know this pre-existing text exists, but it's only the idea that I enjoy. I don't really actually want to read the words, you know?
Yeah, it's really, he says it's really just the germ of the idea that he did anything with.
Okay, yeah.
And John Ridley still kind of sees this as a unpleasant experience for him.
Yeah.
Having sold a script and not seeing anything or hearing anything about it. And then,
except for the money you get for selling a script.
Yeah. Yeah. And the subsequent career, but.
Yeah, well, and also he kind of has a history of making such claims. So I think, like, in this situation, I kind of side with David O. Russell, even though he's somebody that in a lot of David O. Russell's arguments I do not side with. I think he's got, from my understanding of the situation, he's got more of a case, because a similar version of the same thing happened with John Ridley recently with 12 Years a Slave. So,
right, and yeah, and these are two people that. some people have described as difficult to work with.
Yeah.
To put lightly.
Yeah. Just one, while we're still talking about John Ridley, there's one really great anecdote from George Clooney when he was on the set of Ocean's 11. Apparently somebody in between takes said that, the writer of Three Kings is here to see you. And for reasons that we'll get to, George Clooney responds by saying, if it's David, he doesn't want to see me. If it's John, he didn't write Three Kings. And I got a big kick out of that.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can get to the famous Clooney, David O. Russell beef.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Let's build a foundation by actually talking about what's on screen in this movie.
Absolutely. Well, we talked about the foundation, and now we'll talk about what that foundation created. And then we'll talk about sure. the tearing down of that foundation.
Sure, sounds good. Yeah, George, Mark, Ice, and Spike.
Yep.
Running around the desert.
Yep, Three Kings and Spike.
Yeah. What's your history with this movie?
Saw it about a decade ago, enjoyed it, didn't think much of it. And then I was thinking a lot about 90s cinema, like the whole post-Tarantino boom in semi-independent Hollywood cinema of the 90s. I was thinking about that a lot this summer and just sort of got me to revisit the films from that period that I didn't really see a lot. Because, you know, things like Pulp Fiction, I saw a million times. So what's the point of watching them again? And I watched Three Kings again this summer and was like, oh, this movie's really interesting. Yeah. And so I really enjoyed it. And it felt like a movie that you would enjoy. And you had talked about wanting to watch it about 6 months before I watched it again and figured it was a good podcast topic. You know?
Yeah. So you say you saw it a decade ago, which would have been kind of in full swing of the second Gulf War, yes?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I think in analyzing this movie, I'm going to slip into talking about it like it was made, not in 1999, but
yeah.
As a reaction to the Gulf War that I have more firsthand experience with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, firsthand experience on the ground.
Yeah. On the ground of Ontario.
Yeah.
It's remarkable how well this works. For like as commentary on the 2003 invasion of Iraq, though, no?
Oh, absolutely.
They talked about trying to do a re-release of it in 2004, which yeah. For usually a re-release always sounds like a cash grab, and you know maybe this was, but it's
well, there was never much cash made from this in the first place, so that
well, true.
That never seemed like an idea that should have gotten past the discussion phase. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah. Well, it made enough money.
Did it? I thought it kind of flopped a little bit. I didn't look at the money that much.
No, I think it made more than you're suspecting, I think. Gotcha. I think it made like $150 on a $42 million budget.
Oh, really? How many gold blocks is that?
How many golden cubes that you make soup out of?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's... I can't think of another movie that works so well. I mean, some things are... you know, kind of timeless and deals with, you know, themes that recur in, mm-hmm. you know, politics or society. But the fact that all of these actors are still, like, could be cast in this movie just like this today, pretty much, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It wouldn't be, it's not like someone's career got too big.
Well, I mean, Nora Dunn would be an outlier, I think, in that it would be Nora Dunn in a movie.
That's true. Maybe Jamie Kennedy won't sneak in there anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just think that was one of the most incredible things watching this movie is that, you know, it was made almost a decade after the first Gulf War and, you know, I guess 4 years before the 2003 invasion of Iraq and just functions perfectly for both of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think the... to further back up what you're saying about how well it works for the second Gulf War is the fact that there were Gulf War movies made like specifically about the second Gulf War, like Green Zone, and Three Kings is better than all of them. You know, like it is accidentally better about a subject that hadn't even happened yet.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not just better that it uses that it's a more enjoyable movie to watch that happens to have a similar setting. Like mm-hmm. it. it hits the themes and hits the notes of the of what would be relevant about the Second Gulf War really hard on the head, and in a mostly successful way. And that's not to say I liked everything about this movie, but some of the points it presents or seems to present to me sometimes are contradictory to other parts of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's totally a movie I could see being made today with very small changes in it being really pertinent.
Yeah. Oh, I think the hardest part of getting it made today would be getting it made. You know, like, it's a very modern movie, but it's just... I mean, there were a lot of problems in getting this movie made in 1999, and now it's an even more difficult market to get what is a pretty high-budget, fairly adventurous, stylistically film, you know? So that would be the biggest hurdle. It wouldn't be people being able to apply it to modern thought, you know?
And are you attributing that mostly to kind of studios being able to hand out money to a kind of auteur in the post Pulp Fiction kind of landscape in the 90s? Or do you more so attribute it to, you know, big tent poles being the only way to get an action movie made currently?
Yeah, it's a bit of both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, can you talk a bit about kind of the difficulties getting this made and maybe some more of that post-Tarantino landscape that this movie was made in and just the adventurous style of landscaping you were describing? And I think those tie in together.
Well, I think we've wandered into my wheelhouse. mm-hmm. But, you know...
I said Tarantino and filmmaking. I heard the word visuals. I'm listening.
So with Pulp Fiction, was a huge hit, stylistically adventurous, the storytelling was adventurous, and it featured big stars in an independent film. So after that, studio started looking for their version of Tarantino. Like, New Line Cinema locked down Paul Thomas Anderson, and they actually had David O. Russell as well making Flirty with Disaster. And that was the Weinsteins. Maybe it was a co-production. Either way, all of these directors, Spike Jonze would end up being one of them later on in the decade, that had these sort of creative new ideas that were suddenly potentially profitable now that Pulp Fiction had proven that there is a market for really kind of weird cinema. And Three Kings was kind of Warner Brothers' swing. And they're like, oh, David O. Russell, he's made Spanking the Monkey, his first film, and Flirting with Disaster. He's made these kind of zany, weird comedies.
That critics liked.
Yeah, that critics that were certainly well-liked. And they're like, okay, we trust this voice. This will be our voice. And he's got a big idea. Let's make this happen. And I think there was some sort of... internal rumblings within Warner Brothers at the time that they didn't really do anything adventurous, and it was sort of like, this is not the Warner Brothers I remember from my childhood, where we would take risks. And so that led into it as well. And I think what it got was Three Kings, you know, and David O. Russell was able to get, you said $42 million for the budget?
Yeah.
And I know that's cut down. It was higher in David O. Russell's mind initially, but it had to get cut down. But in 1999, $42 million is quite a bit of money. And basically what they were doing was applying small scale Tarantino inspired thought to a much bigger idea than Pulp Fiction was, you know, visually and all that stuff.
Right. And my understanding is that, well, what you've explained is correct. It wasn't as though they were completely gung-ho about it. It seemed as though this was the way that the film industry was moving, and Warner Brothers was kind of apprehensively following along.
Absolutely. And they still needed to get their movie star to be the lead and all that stuff. And there was a lot of fighting between David O. Russell and the studio. One of the studio heads tried to get the film, basically tried to talk George Clooney out of being in the film while another studio head was on vacation, like did it behind his back so that the film would get canceled. And Lorenzo Di Bonaventura was the guy that was on vacation. When he came back, he lost his mind, understandably. But yeah, there was a lot of internal fighting about this movie.
Yeah, and kind of the list of things that I saw Warner Brothers was concerned about was having not kind of financed an auteur film in a long time. Mm-hmm. Was a big problem for them. And David O. Russell is used to working independently, and so they were kind of apprehensive about giving him all this money and him doing what he wanted with it, which is, you know, kind of what you want out of an auteur. But they, you know, as executives, they were going to have notes and they were going to have limitations. Yeah. And they were concerned that Russell wasn't going to kind of play ball with that. Mm-hmm. And being kind of a notoriously difficult person, they're not wrong to think that.
Yeah.
I guess of the limitations that stuck, they shut down they lowered the number of days that he had to shoot. Mm-hmm. And they really wanted to take out some of the more violent scenes and some of the political overtones. So kind of mostly things that you would expect. They want to lower the budget and things like that. They weren't really cool with that slow motion up close shooting of an Iraqi woman to mm-hmm. the skull, not surprisingly. But just from reading kind of some of the pre-production on this, it seemed like, you know, this was really kind of heads butting from very early on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Russell kind of, it became evident to him that there was a lot of coming from the top.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And David O. Russell has always been one to, when there are heads about to butt, kind of lean into it, you know?
So. Yeah. Do you have anything more about the production, or do you want to kind of get to what ends up on screen?
Yeah, let's talk about what's on screen. I think this movie's very good. You know, I mean, we've talked about it, and the thing that I sort of, that really surprised me when I watched it again this summer, that we haven't actually talked about, of course, the Gulf War stuff is interesting, but it's kind of like, it's just bizarro Michael Bay, and I find that so interesting. Like, there are shots in this movie that look like shots from Michael Bay movies, like after Mark Wahlberg's character, Troy Barlow, kills that person at the very beginning of the film when he's standing over the corpse, and there's this low angle shot looking up at him, and it kind of cranes up a little bit. Yep. That exact shot might be in Transformers 4, like, yeah, with the blue sky in the background, Mark Wahlberg craning up, and there's like the slow motion helicopter flyovers. It's just, and the filmmaking's incredible. Like, the cinematography in this movie is bonkers. And the action's really engaging, I find, for the most part. And, but all in all of these things fit in a Michael Bay movie. Even the humor, which is kind of this weird, dark sense of humor, it's just sort of, it all ties in better into making a coherent point than most Michael Bay movies, you know? And it really feels like the middle ground between big Hollywood and interesting thought, you know?
Right. I'd say the humor's a bit darker than Michael Bay.
It's Michael Bay wants to do humor that dark. For yes. Example. Like, Pain and Gain is what Michael Bay wants to do all the time, and that movie features Dwayne The Rock Johnson grilling a hand, you know? Like, it...
Yes.
So, I don't... I think...
It is very funny at times.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't. I should have known you would have looked at it through a Michael Bay lens. But no, I kind of have similar feelings on what kind of the product of this movie is. Mm-hmm. Extremely violent, but not action packed.
Yes,
like there's still plenty of action, but it's not about, you know, the chase scenes and the ducking behind things and jumping over and, you know, buildings topping over and you getting out of the way just in time. Mm-hmm. It's about what happens when a bullet actually strikes a human being.
Yeah.
And we get a cool visual, but something that ties in perfectly thematically with the description of sepsis.
Yes.
When a bullet goes into your body and releases the bile and everything. The violence and the action in this movie, it's really not obsessed with the outward spectacle of war, but like the internal long lasting damages of it.
Yeah.
Which is very anti Michael.
Yeah. Yeah. So
there's a war going on in both movies. But the scenes are going to be, you know, a mother being shot in the head and then her daughter running towards her and kind of the actual implications of what battle and what war and what violence do to people and the actual effects they have on it. Mm-hmm. And less about, you know, as I said, the chasing and jumping and all kind of the fun spectacle kind of stuff that you care about when you're playing war when you're a kid. You know what I mean? Like, all that stuff's gone.
Not entirely. They still throw exploding right. Nerf footballs.
Oh, yes, yes. Definitely not entirely gone.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But that is the Spike Jones idiot character injecting them into the film, right? So.
Right. And to the kind of just the other end of the spectrum altogether. The sepsis thing is really cool, you know, visually. And it's not like this movie is devoid of spectacle, because we've talked about how it is very adventurous stylistically and, you know, really stylish overall, and does about a billion things to remind you you're watching a movie at all time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is to say it is very stylish in another way. But it's just so much different than, you know, the kind of Michael Bay pure Hollywood action, we're all having fun shooting guns and running around kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like you said, the shot of sepsis, that conversation and the way it's visually represented, the mother being shot in the head, and Troy later, when Troy gets shot and Archie Gates is explaining what happened to him. All of these things are so well made, like they're so engagingly shot and made, but they're all done in a really horrifying way. And it's sort of the big, most important moments are David O. Russell makes sure that they are horrifying, like they're not pleasant to watch, you know. And that's sort of where the where it strays from the Michael Bay thing. And the whole idea of the film is about the difference between, I think, how soldiers see themselves and how other people see soldiers. And I feel like that sort of really fits in with, you know, how action movie directors see action and how David O. Russell sees action, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And one point that speaks to that is the sounds of gunshots is even turned down in this movie, which in a action movie, I guess you just want the quick cuts and the fast moving action and the loud sounds and the bright colors and things like that. And, you know, counterintuitively, this movie again kind of just plays up, you know, not the guns but the gunshot victims. And, you know, that's when they have the most kind of thought put into this movie, I think, is not, you know, what's going to be the cool way to shoot someone. It's going to be what's going to be the emotionally impactful way to kind of have the result of this resonate with our audience. And it's very emotionally effective at times.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so all over the place.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think there's kind of a lot to this movie, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Like, well, you had mentioned you think there are some things that are very contradictory. I'm curious to know what those things are.
It's something I think we've talked about before, kind of the white savior trope. Mm-hmm. As though a lot of this movie is about how bad America and the American government is, and then a lot of this movie is about how, you know, our Americans in this movie, being the 3/4 kings,
mm-hmm.
Are the only reason these Iraqis, you know, survive, the ones that do at least. And I know it's a tough line to draw between the American government, American military, these American soldiers, these particular American soldiers. It's just a little bit scattered to me, and just not ultimately empowering to who I think to empower.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Sense to you?
Yep, for sure.
And just it's a little muddled, and I kind of wanted to talk this out with you, is because I'm not always sure about character motivations in this movie, and there are some surprises that happen that I don't know if they're the good kind of surprise, like when I like a twist, versus when I'm just kind of dumbfounded by sudden changes of heart.
Okay.
But that's something I want to ask you about, because one of the things I do like about this movie is that we're not always, you know, clear cut. And I know I'm kind of sounding contradictory myself in describing this. I like that, you know, our three kings, and I'm purposely leaving Spike out of this because he's not a thinking character.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just ignore him for this part of the discussion, because I think the movie lets you ignore him for this part of the discussion pretty easily. Mm-hmm. They all have different motivations, and they're all different characters. And, you know, we see, Mark Wahlberg trying to convince George Clooney to, you know, just leave the town. Okay, we got the gold. Let's go. Let's stick to the plan. And that's a line that he used on him. He used the other way earlier. You know, let's stick to the plan. So we kind of have these shifting moralities and people kind of making different decisions about what's best for these Iraqis that they've come across, and what's best for their families, and what's best for, you know, your little kid who is born, who's still in the States, and things like that. I did kind of enjoy that it wasn't completely linear. Like, everyone makes up their mind at the same time, and everyone mm-hmm. changes their mind simultaneously. And there's that moment where George Clooney, a little too brazen and heroic, in my opinion, but decides that they're not going to let this, village go to shit after the woman's shot. And he goes and disarms the guy like a ninja and walks, and goes free, maybe.
Well, yeah, and the point where he gets that guy to shoot himself in the leg or the foot by, like, grabbing the gun barrel.
That's a firefight.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like that would also cause problematic issues with his hand that was on the gun.
Yeah, probably.
Like, I don't know a lot about weaponry, but I feel like, I don't know, there's some repercussions there.
Yeah, but, you know, I did enjoy kind of that Troy, Mark Wahlberg's character, begrudgingly gets out of the vehicle and helps him. You know, he's clearly not down for this decision, but, you know, we're a team. You are still kind of a commanding officer, despite the fact that we're completely AWOL at the moment.
Yeah.
I did enjoy kind of the begrudging camaraderie between them, and most of the interpersonal relationships in this movie were handled well. Okay. And with a sense of realism.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I agree with you about the contradictory things. I think the ending is the biggest part jumps out at you.
This movie gets so bad at the end.
The music is... Because the music in this movie is really interesting, because it's... I mean, there's a lot of jazz drumming in this film, which seems contradictory to a war film. And at the end is when the music gets really conventional, because that's when the ending gets really conventional. And for a movie that really tries to stray away from convention as much as possible in the preceding 110 minutes, it's kind of frustrating at the end. Yeah.
And it's such a bad song.
Well, yeah, and then, like, the piece of score is really bad, and then the actual end credits song is really bad.
And what about the end credits? What about everyone getting their little...
Their little just desserts, if you will?
Just deserts.
Yeah. No, they just left the desert, James.
Right.
I thought it was fine. I don't know. I don't feel any way about it, really.
Oh, I thought it'd be a little too... cheesy and cute for you.
I mean, had the rest of it been great, maybe I would have had more of a problem with it, but it's better than the music that they're turning their backs and walking away from. Yeah.
Right. Did you expect any of our three kings to die?
I don't know. I guess, because I mean, I don't remember. I knew they all made it out of the movie when I was watching it again this year, so I don't remember how I felt when I first saw it. You?
I expected someone to die. Yeah. I expected Spike to die about four times. Yeah, I really thought one of them was going to go, but I don't know who. Mm-hmm. I think I would have been most upset about George Clooney dying in that it would have been way too Jesus-y, and not because I love George Clooney so much, because we know that's not the case.
He rides one of the Nerf footballs like it's in Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah. Well, how did you feel about the Nerf footballs?
I think they're fine.
Yeah.
For a movie that's so, I think it's a pretty over the top movie that just sort of tries to tie itself into real life. I don't think they jump out at me, and I think it's as a fan of action movies, kind of awesome. And it's this really wonderfully American symbol for them to throw as well, which I think is really great. Had they been actual like leather footballs, would have been the only way it could have been better, as far as I'm concerned.
Signed by Brett Favre.
Yes. Well, this is 1991. He's not even playing in Atlanta yet, let alone Green Bay.
that scene though, it's, as you said, you know, it's very American. Tons of American iconography as they kind of move the camera up that Humvee. Mm-hmm. Most on the nose with the American flag, but we have Bart Simpson. Mm-hmm. An explosive Nerf footballs, and that whole scene kind of together, you know, just the beginning as we're seeing him ride like that, reminded me both of Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket. Apocalypse Now for the surfing scene. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of bringing this American sport, not that surfing is American, but you know, a big part of American culture at the time. Mm-hmm. And football in this, you know, war zone, you know, not officially a war zone at this point, but a very dangerous place covered with landmines and angry people with guns.
Yeah.
And the Homer Simpson reminded me of when they all
Bart Simpson.
Yes, yeah. You're right. When they're all singing the Mickey Mouse theme song at the end of Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's just what right away it reminded me of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about that, but my two comparison points for this movie, for like David O. Russell when he was making it, were almost certainly Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket.
Right, and this movie has more fun than both of those movies combined, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but sort of like Full Metal Jacket has this weird sort of level of thought and to it, and Apocalypse Now is kind of more of a horror movie. You know, it yes. Really wants you to understand how horrifying things are,
yeah. And wants you to have no fun at all.
Yeah.
So speaking of this movie having fun,
okay,
and the Nerf football scene after the cow explodes in their little test run, mm-hmm. We have kind of the most fun scene I think of the whole movie,
and which is where they find the gold.
No, this turns into like a summer road trip movie for like 3 minutes with the Beach Boys music.
Yeah,
playing.
Okay, yeah.
Camera,
yeah.
You didn't think that?
And what camera? Sorry,
the camera seems to be different. I thought like the ratio or something about it was different.
I don't know. I don't remember specifically. I guess.
Okay. It just seemed like it was. This movie. I was reading a bit about it. Maybe you can explain a bit more about some of the negative film stock and that coloration.
Ektachrome.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they just sure. I suspect that it was almost entirely used for exteriors. Not every exterior, like the intro, wasn't shot on it. They just did a bleach bypass on that, which we've talked about in the past. Like Fight Club did it, where it just sort of makes the blacks darker, where you process the film in a way that sort of removes the silver. I think they do something with the silver in the film stock, and it really brings down the blacks. And you can see that in pretty much every aspect of this film. But for a lot of the exteriors, they shot on Ektachrome. And I suspect that's the film stock that gives the weird sort of blue look to a lot of things. Like you can really see it in the scene where they're covered in milk, because they're covered in white stuff that you know is white, but has this weird blue feel to it. And I think... David O. Russell explained wanting to use it just because it gives this sort of weird sort of off-kilter look to reality, which is how they wanted to approach this film. And yeah, I think that's sort of the idea behind Ektachrome. And I think anytime you see something that's bluer than what you are used to in a film, it's probably that film stock.
Yeah, it's really striking.
Yes, it is.
Like from the first frames of this movie, you know, outside when it's, you know, Mark Wahlberg about to kill that guy who seems to be attempting to surrender.
Yeah, and that's not Ektachrome, but yes, it is still very stylish, like what I talked about, the bleach bypass thing.
Yeah, it's, I just, in general, this movie, like, from the first frame, just in all the color choices, mm-hmm. is very, very striking.
Yeah, and there's a lot of really wide angle shots in this movie, like lenses, specifically that first shot where we're following behind what we find out is, you know, the path Troy is about to be on, and just this really, really wide angle, and it kind of gives this a little bit of a distorted look to it. And there are a lot of characters or focus points in like the corners of the screen in this film, like the in that shot, using that as a sort of example, Mark Wahlberg's head is the very bottom right corner of the frame, which is very odd. And there are very a lot of examples of that in this movie, and I think it gives it a really interesting stylistic feel that we're a bit off center in this movie, you know. And I think it's they really push it to the extreme, and I like it a lot.
Yeah, no, it's something I did like a lot, and something, I mean, I haven't seen everything David O. Russell's made, so I wasn't quite sure what I was expecting from this movie. Mm-hmm. This wasn't it, for sure.
Yeah.
But I liked it, and I liked that it did.
Were you expecting Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence to make out at the end in a swirling Steadicam makeout?
I just thought this was the 2-hour dance version of Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah.
The one plot point of that movie I like, just blown out for 3 hours.
Exactly.
No, but just a very visually arresting right from the first frame.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, well, I believe it's the first line of dialogue in the movie, at least the first part of intelligible dialogue, is Troy saying, "Are we shooting?"
Yeah.
Which to me, like, I watched this movie twice quickly because I thought there was a ton of stuff in here and I had never seen it. And I thought there was just a lot going on to kind of unpack and understand. So I watched it pretty quickly again.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely more so the second time is when I thought about this. But that line, "Are we shooting?" It reminds you of filmmaking and war at the same time.
Yeah, that's true.
And the first thing, and it simultaneously draws attention to the fact that we're watching a movie, which is something that, as I said, kind of they hit you over the head with in this movie a lot. But also draws attention to the fact that there's just so much confusion, you know, around the Gulf War in general, just the muddled sense of morality between characters and institutions and militaries. It's, you know, it's just really all over the place. And there's just a sense of confusion throughout this movie. How often do you have people yelling at each other who can't understand each other? Mm-hmm. People not understanding each other's motivations, people not showing what they're doing, what they're going to do next, why they're doing it. And I just thought kind of just that one line does a lot of things really quickly. And something I obviously appreciate a lot.
Absolutely. And I think as we see throughout the film, Troy is really established to be sort of the character we are supposed to be able to put ourselves into the most, like the average viewer. And at that, you know, we get him. He is kind of the most, he seems like the most normal person, even though he talks with that weird inflection that Mark Wahlberg talks with.
Yeah.
He's really supposed to be the normal American boy, you know, and that's why they cast somebody that looks like Mark Wahlberg. They want him to sort of be ideal normal American. And throughout the movie, we get these scenes where we see Mark Wahlberg be that character. And particularly when he's about 10 minutes later, probably when they are forcing people to strip and Conrad is pointing a gun at people and Troy's telling him not to do that. It's like, we can do this professionally. Like, he's supposed to sort of inject sort of a normal person's logic into these situations where characters are acting insane, which sort of adds more to the opening scene that you were discussing where, the most normal person in the bunch doesn't understand what's happening. You know, the most logical of the group doesn't get it. And so it's just like, well, fuck it. I guess I'll shoot him, you know? So.
And that's one more thing that I kind of mean by it's a bit, the movie's a bit contradictory and kind of, that's why I still don't know where to really stand on it. Like, I understand it's a well-made film and I appreciate that. And I would watch this movie again easily. But just to take his character again, as you were saying, he's kind of an everyman, but he's also functions as kind of a criticism of the American government's handling of all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you said, it's Mark Wahlberg. Like, it's he's kind of got this oblivious sincerity. Like, he'll often talk about doing the right thing in this movie and then follow it up by doing a terrible thing. He berates someone for using two offensive terms for Iraqis and then follows it up with two more other offensive terms. Yeah. Like, I guess less offensive, but still pretty fucking awful.
Yeah. They weren't offensive to Ice Cube, who is currently in the room.
Yeah, and I just feel like there's so much of that in this movie. With the character of Troy, where you could say he's a good everyman trying to do a good thing, but then you could also say he's just a dumb American who feels like he can do whatever he wants no matter where he is. And there's definitely just so much play in there. And it's something that, yeah, Mark Wahlberg can bring to a movie so well. I mean, we talked about it a bit in Boogie Nights, but there's this dumb sincerity about him that I can't find to that degree in anyone else. And it can be so funny and it can be so entertaining, and it can also serve a dramatic function as it does in this movie. You know, while he is also just straight up funny in this movie, there's just so many parts. I mean, I'm not saying you, but I just did not know what to make of him. And
yeah,
sometimes it results in a good laugh, and then sometimes I stop laughing and I think about what is it, and I don't feel bad for laughing, but I find myself just struggling how David O. Russell wants me to read this. And I am totally okay with reading a movie anyway, not the way that the writer or director or anyone involved in the movie did it. But I do find myself genuinely perplexed. Like, maybe he's just going for the laughs. There's that one scene in the desert after they kind of think he's gone... he's shell-shocked, sorry, in the desert. It's a horrible description for a part of this movie.
He's in that place that all of this movie happens in.
Yeah, it looks hot. You remember that part? No, but he approaches someone who, one of the Iraqis that, you know, George and Ice have made friends with, but he's not aware of it yet. And he's like, yeah, outstanding, excellent. How can we help you?
Yeah, yeah, and it's right after he's been rescued.
Yeah, exactly. It's right then. And so they think he's kind of lost his mind a bit, and that's what it is. But it's like, no, Mark Wahlberg would do something like that all the time. And it is so funny, and it is so genuine, but it's so backwards, and it's so funny because it's not the way anyone would act in their right mind.
Well, correct. But I think the characterization of Troy is one of my favorite parts of this movie, because I think he is kind of – he doesn't have – so, you know, he's figuring out what he believes basically in this movie. I don't think he's supposed to have a strong sense of view of anything that he's doing. He's supposed to be he's doing what he thinks is right at all times, but he doesn't necessarily know that what he's doing is right. And I think the are we shooting scene is a very because I mean, he basically shrugs his shoulders and then shoots the person, you know.
I was honestly gonna say just that, like, yeah, he's not doing it for a fucking giggle.
Yeah,
he's just, well, that appears to be an Iraqi who has a weapon, so I guess I shoot.
Yeah. And
then everyone celebrates, and so it's like, okay, I guess that was the right thing to do. Let's have a party, let's get wasted.
Yeah. Let's proudly stand up next to you. And the scene that you were talking about with the slurs, he knows that the slurs Conrad were saying offend Ice Cube, because Ice Cube says that this offends me. So that's why Troy cuts him off. And he knows that the other terms he uses doesn't offend anybody in the immediate vicinity. So he knows they're fine in that situation, or he thinks they're fine in that situation, because they don't cause anybody in the room undue harm. And at the end, I think he's supposed to be, his whole interrogation scene is supposed to show us that, you know, we're putting the most normal or the most identifiable one in this interrogation sequence. And the guy that is interrogating him is purposely set up as a character who explains a backstory of sorts for himself. And they're tying the two characters together so that they're supposed to be seen as similar people doing different actions in that sequence. And when Troy gets free of that, he understands how lucky he is, and that's why he's just sort of walking on air, I guess, and doing his going full Wahlberg, if you will. And
why he doesn't shoot him in the head.
Yeah, exactly. And he's just so happy and pleased that he doesn't really care what's around him at the moment because of what he just survived. You know, he doesn't really see danger like he did a week ago, you know.
Right. Yeah. And those two characters are coupled. You know, we're supposed to see them as similar. And Mark Wahlberg kind of says, like, yeah, I'm a father, too. And the Iraqi says, no, I'm not a father anymore. Remember, yeah. Like, we have these two characters who might have had similar lives, but because of this war and the way things played out militarily, well, this guy doesn't have a kid anymore.
Exactly. And we see these cutaways to, well, what if what happened to my family happened to your family? And I think that that's a really interesting moment in the movie where we cut back to Mark Wahlberg's wife in slow motion. These very like Terrence Malick-y shots, but then the house explodes, you know? It really strongly backs up what we've been discussing, basically.
Yeah. And that guy's really good, eh?
He's good in everything. I can't pronounce his last name, but his first name's Saeed.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, no, he doesn't have a huge part, but I think like for a lot of it, he's not speaking. Like, there's so much time where he's watching things happen, and his performance is remarkably engaging.
Yeah, and I think the only other key actor in this film that we haven't mentioned is Cliff Curtis, who I also think is good in everything. Yeah.
Okay.
He's Aaliyah Shawkat's dad.
Yeah, Judy Greer.
Yeah, she has such a small role. I mean, yeah. This is the type of role she knocks out of the park all the time.
Yeah. True. Yeah. The cinematographer of this movie?
Newton Thomas Siegel.
Yeah.
He's good. I mean, he's Bryan Singer's go-to guy. I think Three Kings, of what I've seen of his, is far and away the best-looking movie he's made.
Okay.
Yeah. He's not he's not on my top five or anything of somebody that even if a shitty director directs a movie, I'm going to see it just because of who shot it, you know?
Okay.
But he's certainly very, very skilled.
Yeah, just to kind of speak to the realism of the gunfights in this, I guess his career was started. He did a lot of documentaries about Civil War in South America and violence in South America. And David O. Russell just kind of said, you know, I chose him because he knows how to live in that world. And just kind of building on what we had just said and what we had said earlier, this movie really isn't played out for, like, the fun action scenes at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And, yeah, it just reminded me of that when you were talking about that torture scene when he's pouring shoves a jewel case in his mouth and pours oil down his throat. It's super unpleasant, and kind of that whole scene is unpleasant. Everything underground there. This movie, you know, has a fast pace. It's definitely lighthearted at times, but the movie really slows down there, and I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, it gets like it's dragging. It's just kind of really coming to terms with what war means.
Yeah. And
it's a goal of this, you know, war movie to deal with the actual ramifications of war and not the spectacle of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that scene is, I think, specifically put towards the very middle of the film. I think it's a bit more in the second half, but it's meant to be sort of the slow down and think about what's happening, where these two sort of different sides meet and realize they're kind of alike. One of the things that I love about this movie is how frequently our main characters say we are the United States Army and then immediately expect people to listen to whatever comes after that. Yeah. And I think one of the best examples of that is when they're trying to explain why they should be given the cars towards the end, and George Clooney's Archie Gates is saying we're the United States Army and then giving this whole rah-rah speech, and then people don't buy in. But like in the lead up to that rah-rah speech, Cliff Curtis's character says you're three soldiers with a bunch of civilians and no Humvee, and I think that really sums it up in that they are the United States Army, but that phrase doesn't have the power that they think it should, you know?
Yeah, and just as they arrive the first time to get the gold, he's just holding up something that says it's signed by George Bush. And, just the amazing timing of those presidents having the same name. I know that they're related, but it's like just even for parts like that when they're actually saying the president's name, it just works so fucking well. He's like almost hiding his face behind that decree for a while. You know what I mean? Like literally hiding behind a piece of like a government document from the president as a reason why he can just walk in and take whatever he wants.
Exactly. And I think I mentioned that that point gets hit on a lot throughout the film. I think the climax of the film is really interesting because it's built around them pretending to be something they're not. They send in that car saying, Saddam's coming to freak everybody out. And, yeah, you know, they're not Saddam. And the whole film, I think, is in some way about basically the United States pretending to be something they're actually not. Like, if we're looking at our three kings as or the army in general as sort of representation of America, you know, we get them explaining in the beginning, we liberated Kuwait, you know, they see themselves as liberators, protectors. And I think all of our three kings sort of go from, you know, thinking that they are doing legitimate good to not being sure. The movie, they keep talking about themselves as, you know, liberators and protectors, but they're actually just thieves. You know, they're actually just out for the gold, and they don't really care about what happens in between. They just see the end. And I think that is the really strong point that really covers the whole movie. And I think that's what makes this movie really strong. And certainly for David O. Russell, it's easily his best movie, I think. But I think that's sort of what ties together all of the things that, even when there are some contradictory things and some shitty things, like at the end when they realize they actually have become protectors and the music turns to this much more conventional protecting music and U2 saves us all. That's part of a bigger idea that works, you know, even though that small idea within it doesn't.
To build on what you said, I'd never really considered before, but, you know, they think, as I said, they kind of go in with this thing from George Bush and say, you know, this is what gives us the right, you know, is this piece of paper, and it's signed by our leader and your leader and all these things. But it's going in pretending to be Saddam that is effective. You know, it's like they're finally living in someone else's world where it's like, no, but George Bush isn't their leader. That's not the person that they have dealt with or have to deal with, or they can relate to or identify with, or it means anything to. Like, you're in this country now. There are different rules. There are different, this is different everything. We care about different things. So even something as small, like it's very deceptive and terrible, but pretending to be their leader to threaten, like to scare them off, at least it shows that, they're kind of getting into the Iraqi mentality of like, these are the things and these are the people you care about and the things that you know, not so much this thing on the other side of the world from you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's a good point.
I have a question for you just because this is something I'm curious about, and you might be the only person that I talk to regularly that's seen this film. How did you feel about the Mark Wahlberg, like, after he's been shot? Did you feel like any tension in the him not being able to breathe scene, and they're trying to talk Jim Gaffigan into opening the valve for him?
Yeah, I like, that was a moment when I thought someone would die. So okay. I guess I did feel tension. I was so convinced that it wasn't going to amount to anything.
No, that type of thing just always gets me when a character can't breathe. And I wasn't sure if it's like good filmmaking or just because I'm asthmatic, you know, and I understand. I think that scene is very effective, like comparably to I mentioned how I think the scene where the mother gets shot early on is quite horrifying, but had a real sort of actual reaction to this movie in that sequence. Yeah.
Mine probably wasn't as bad as yours, but especially because it went like a beat and a half longer than I thought they would let it go if they were going to save him.
Yeah.
Like, I thought they're either going to play this out for like 45 seconds and fix it, or he's going to be dead. And I think it would have been really powerful if he died in a kind of a much different ending to the movie. But yeah, I thought I definitely was not sure of which way that was going to go. So that was effective for me, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I think another one of my favorite scenes in this movie that we've only kind of touched on is right after he gets shot. And this is mostly just filmmaking wise, and I think it's just really engaging, the shot of inside his body and Archie explaining what's happening inside his body and then them fixing it. And there's that shot from Troy's perspective where Ice Cube is framed in he's looking up, while he's lying on the ground. Ice Cube's framed in the bottom left. George Clooney comes in from out of nowhere, like from the background in slow motion. And he just comes from the back of the frame towards the frame and says, can you breathe, or something like that. And that shot is so gorgeous. And that whole sequence of them making Mark Wahlberg be able to breathe, I found really engaging.
Yeah, and him kind of looking over at Conrad and the two of them not really being aware of Conrad. Well, being aware, but they're doing, you know, they're doing the right thing at that point.
Yeah, Conrad's, they kind of understand Conrad's a lost cause. And
yeah, Conrad's a lost cause. There's someone here who's still very much savable, but very much in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of just the, like, the pain in Troy's face as he kind of realizes that, you know, well, maybe not realizes, but understands that Conrad always kind of idolized him and he just is such an unnecessary death, really. And it's kind of the only time that he's really struggled with that until that point in the movie. So I thought that was an effective scene for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I
didn't really have anything to say. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I just had to inhale really quickly. I was just thinking about not being able to breathe again.
I'm the resident asthmatic. That's my...
Very early on in the film when... in another relevant to 2003 kind of way, Clooney and his command is captain, I guess? Or he's a captain?
I don't know. I don't know.
Anyway.
Staff sergeant, isn't that it?
Ooh, that sounds smart. let's go with that. You know, they're arguing and he says, I don't even know what we did here. And his staff sergeant retorts, what do you want to do, occupy Iraq and redo Vietnam? Mm-hmm. Which, again, is something we heard a million times around our Gulf War.
Yeah.
What did you think about the kind of choppy takeoff of the helicopter and then going into the next scene of washing the hands?
That's something I hate.
You hate the visual hand-washing metaphor.
Well, not even that so much, as because I was so up in arms about the filmmaking choice to sort of... Because so what they do basically is in that is they elongate a frame probably two times more than they should, so it has this sort of choppy feel, and remove some, yeah, which is different from what they do to make you be able to see the helicopter rotors turning, because you have to shutter down to see that, like they adjust the shutter. That's a thing that's decided in camera. But I think the removal of frames process is something that's done after the fact, and that's something I hate. It's something that it doesn't look good and was clearly done in editing and could have been undone. That's something that drives me crazy in movies, you know. And this is most readily seen generally when people decide they want something they shot not in a higher frame rate to be slow motion, and you sort of see this really like blurry slow motion and it looks like garbage, and it happens so frequently, and I don't understand how there isn't like a rule in Hollywood against it.
And so what's the thought process there? Is David Russell, I know you don't know, but David Russell just thinking, I haven't done enough weird visual shit, or this was a big important discussion that we're going to give you a bit of time to kind of digest?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Do you have a thought on it?
I actually do like part of the shot, but it's not the effect.
The shot's gorgeous of the helicopter taking off. That's another part that upsets me, because that scene is framed so well. The wide shot where George Clooney and McKelty Williamson are talking to each other is framed so well. And then it's just sort of, well, you know, let's shit on this gorgeous frame. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really... And I'm speaking purely with kind of disregarding that choppy visual effect. Yeah. You're disgusting. I thought the discussion's good, like maybe a bit too heavy handed, but that's only because I'm overthinking it. Like if I had seen this movie once, I would say that was a kind of necessary thing to be done in that manner at that time, because it puts you, it frames a lot of this movie for you and where Archie Gates, George Clooney is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But just the sight of the helicopter taking off and the actual scene there, like, as you said, it's framed so nicely. And there's these kind of two sets of chairs and a table with a box on it. And it's in the middle of, an operating base in a recently designated otherwise war zone.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something that looks really domestic and serene about it. Mm-hmm. Like, even though they've just had this big argument, when he's gone and Clooney's just sitting there on his own, and it's not symmetrical, but we kind of have the chairs paired off, and just, as you said, a well-framed picture. And then we have, you know, him, Staff Sergeant gets in the plane, the helicopter, the rotors go, it starts knocking all these chairs over and kicking up all this sand, and it's really, really loud. And there's kind of this nice visual scene that's just destroyed. And, but...
Nothing. Destroyed as a double, you know, means two things there to me.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. It's just kind of this, I don't know, one little bit of military might and volume ruining kind of a domestic scene. And, you know, this was a place where a discussion was happening and it was never really decided. One person just left and then knocked everything over. Like, mm-hmm. It was just kind of, I think a lot of people's take on American foreign policy summed up really quickly. It was like, okay, well, let's have a discussion about who's right and who's wrong here. The person higher up in the ladder says, no, we're not going to have that discussion because someone up above me said, we're not having this discussion. Mm-hmm. And then we're kind of left with someone thoughtful being really dejected as everything around him, you know, kind of falls over and falls apart. And I thought it was a nice little visual scene. That's, you know, not a crazy strong metaphor, like being, and kind of the whole choppy effect really takes me out of it. And then that goes kind of right into the hand washing scene, which bugs me as well. Like, I think that, you know, and there's a reason for this one. It's not just guilt. He's been handling the Iraqi ass map. You do want to you do want to wash your hands after that.
Just so many serious points, and then you just go into the Iraqi ass map. Like, that's a normal fucking thing to say.
Well, that's what Mark Wahlberg does this whole movie.
I know, but you don't sound like Mark Wahlberg when you talk, so it's more alarming when it comes from you, or more surprising, I guess. I'm not up in arms terrified or anything, but sorry, continue your well thought out point about the Iraqi ass map.
I was just kidding. To ask you, how you doing? You doing good? Are you sure I don't sound like Mark Wahlberg?
Yeah, exactly. Just as a quick correction of something we were talking about, the Staff Sergeant, Ice Cube is actually the Staff Sergeant. That's why that's in my head. He's Staff Sergeant Chief Elgin. Archie Gates is a major. McKelty Williamson, the other character we were just talking about, is a colonel.
Right. So. And that's why he's probably going to be general soon. I think this is a discussion about clinching the star.
Gotcha.
Good. I didn't want all those veterans and active military service members who listen to our podcast to come looking for me.
It's something we actually got wrong that we were able to correct, as opposed to all those other things we get wrong when we just spout hypotheses for no reason and just never correct. You know, I feel like we're doing good work here. Right?
Yeah. Okay, good. We're doing the right thing.
So I guess we should talk about the production troubles, I think, we haven't talked about, I guess.
God, I forgot all about
the most that. Famous one.
I know. I was actually thinking about this movie for a while, not the other things.
Well, I guess to sum it up, George Clooney punched the director of this film in the face on set.
Back it up a bit more than that.
Well, okay. David O. Russell never wanted George Clooney to be in this movie. Another good anecdote that I've got is the he thought he just squinted a lot on ER, and that was kind of the basis of his acting. And he had a lot of tics that David O. Russell didn't like, and he called up his mom when people were trying to convince him to cast George Clooney, and he said, they want me to cast George Clooney. And his mom said, is that the guy that just squints a lot on the doctor show? And I thought that was really funny.
That's why David O. Russell's David O. Russell.
Yeah, exactly. And, he didn't want to cast George Clooney, but, Warner Brothers had a relationship with George Clooney, and, he was a star on the rise. He was still on ER, I think, his last season, at this point. And he was sort of forced into it. I think, like, Nicolas Cage was the other one that there seemed to be serious discussions with.
God, I want that movie.
See, I don't. I think Clooney fits this movie better.
Oh, 100%. As someone who likes Nicolas Cage a lot more than George Clooney.
I like Nicolas Cage a lot more than George Clooney. And I like George Clooney way more than I like you. I like also that, but I like... or than you like George Clooney. Sorry.
I did not disagree. Yeah. This would have been, yeah, this is not the movie for Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. And I think this movie really, I think George Clooney is really this sort of strong through line that really helps calm everything down and sort of give it, some sort of sober thought that I definitely think Nicolas Cage would have removed. But anyway.
Go ahead. He just kind of has this and Oceans and a lot of things I can think of. He's just always kind of trying to keep things cool when things are going off the rails.
Absolutely. And I think...
Whereas Nicolas Cage takes things that are off the rails and like hooks a jetpack to it and flies it all around.
Flies it to a new set of rails, which he then destroys. Yeah. But I think one of the most important lines Clooney has in this movie is the... I think it's right before the climax when he says, the way this works is, and I think he's talking to Spike Jonze, the way this works is you do the thing you're scared shitless of, then you get the courage after you do it, not before you do it. And just imagining Nicolas Cage say that line, I don't think it would sound calming at all. But when George Clooney says it, like he's explaining it like he's terrified, but he still sounds calm. And I think Nicolas Cage would be explaining it like he's kind of terrified, but also confused and... clearly gonna make the situation worse just with his presence. I don't know, there's some weird thing with that, but anyway, that's who David O. Russell wanted. Nicolas Cage chose Martin Scorsese over him, went to make Bringing of the Dead, and then just Warner Brothers, the last person they would approve was George Clooney, so it was George Clooney or no movie basically. And they had a lot of pre-production meetings, David O. Russell and George Clooney, to quote-unquote break George Clooney's bad habits. It was just David O. Russell's idea that George Clooney was okay with going along with. I think there was yoga involved in one of their pre-production meetings, which George Clooney was not super happy about, but seemed to be taking it fairly professionally. And then on the set, David O. Russell is... I don't know if he's still this way, because he seems to have gone through a bit of personal growth over the last 10 years or so, but...
It was the dance contest that did it for him.
Well, I think the Silver Linings Playbook is kind of his movie about that, but or his growth, might make him a worse filmmaker, but maybe he's not a shitty person anymore. He would do a lot of textbook tyrannical director things, like scream at the crew, like, oh, we have to be rolling right now, we're rolling right now, changing the script on the fly, all of these things that George Clooney isn't really into and doesn't support. He doesn't like it when crew members get yelled at. He's referred to in the business as somebody that's a good down, bad up, which means he's really great with the crew and the quote-unquote normal people, and kind of like is willing to stand up to the people higher above him on the food chain, like the director, studio head, stuff like that. And so there was a lot of that on the set that sort of came to a head very late in production, when David O. Russell threw down an extra to show, I think, Mark Wahlberg how to throw somebody down. And George Clooney was really not into that. He thought there was a little bit too much violence, and there had been a lot of back and forth notes being sent to each other. George Clooney seems to like writing notes a lot. And so there was clearly signs of this coming to a head at some point. But he stood up to David O. Russell. David O. Russell basically challenged him to punch him. And George Clooney punched him. And one of the assistant directors quit on the spot. Like, just put down his camera and walked off set.
That's my favorite part of this whole story for some reason.
Yeah. In one of the books I've read about the 90s in cinema, it's just he quietly put down his camera and walked off set. And
I love it.
Yeah, exactly. And and that's kind of the basis of it. And they ended up getting through it. They've talked some shit about each other in the press since. Yeah, that's kind of the story, right?
Yeah, even when making movies about standing up to tyranny, George Clooney is constantly standing up to tyranny.
He just can't stop doing it.
No, it's in his blood.
This set, like this time period for a lot of people in this movie seemed to be a particularly trying one. I think pretty much, well, George Clooney specifically was, he was doing four days on this movie and then would go to three days on ER. So he's working 7 day weeks. David O. Russell, his wife at the time, I think they're divorced now, they had a 4-year-old and they had just found out their 4-year-old was autistic. So he was flying back to LA They were shooting this in Arizona. He was flying back to LA basically whenever he would get the chance. And just as a side note, I mean, I think if anything, Spike Jonze would run away from any conflict. But if there were any conflicts involving Spike Jonze, he was editing. He was flying back to LA to edit Being John Malkovich on the weekends.
Right. Yeah. And Ice Cube is just cool as a motherfucker.
Yeah, Ice Cube and Mark Wahlberg spent a lot of time having barbecues together, basically.
Good stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to come back next week when we'll be talking about Gone Girl, a movie by one of those other.
Guys, I'm so excited.
I know. You seem more excited about a David Fincher movie than I am, and I'm very uncomfortable by that.
I have so many questions.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, this is making me more uncomfortable than an actual David Fincher movie. Your excitement of it. But yeah, be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about Gone Girl. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.